Thanks for listening to Outcast World. You lock your front door, don't you? You wouldn't go out and leave the front door open. Well, that's essentially what you're doing when you're not using a VPN. Right now, your data is being tracked, stored, and sold by loads of people. For a lot of people that are listening to this show, that is not just annoying, it can also be very risky. NordVPN fixes it. It's fast, it's reliable, it's number one for consumers, and it takes less time to set up than ordering a takeaway. Outcast World listeners can get NordVPN for under £3 a month. That is up to 75% off. Just go to outcastworld.net. The link's at the top. Turn it on. Forget about it. Make yourself safer online with the number one NordVPN for under £3 a month at outcastworld.net. Right, welcome to Outcast World. The stuff I'm saying to you may change in the next few days. I don't think we've ever recorded an episode under these kind of circumstances. But anyway, Andy Burnham is back in Parliament and the seat was never really the point, was it? Close to 55%, a majority north of 9,000 in a town that went reform top to bottom just 6 weeks ago. But Makerfield was only ever really the door, wasn't it? What sits on the other side of it is the leadership of the Labour Party and, obviously, being Prime Minister. And after a night like this, the question is no longer when he walks through that door, it's a case of when. The post-mortem starts with the man Reform sent in to stop him.
You described yourself as a sexist. You have made offensive comments about women. You've admitted that. You've also said that abortion is the cowardly act of women murdering defenceless baby and that women do it so they can shag anyone they want. That's your phrase, not mine.
Candidate that toxic should have gifted Burnham an easy night, and guess what? It did. But notice the one line they kept swinging anyway. Not the economy, not borders, although they love going on about borders. It's this one.
What is a woman? Andy Burnham, who wants to be the next Prime Minister, doesn't seem to know.
Gender-critical feminist Rosie Duffield had supported Burnham to be the next leader, but is she having second thoughts?
The thing is that I just know that's what politicians do, particularly men who don't want to deal with this issue, and he probably didn't expect it. He probably didn't necessarily know where we had got to in Westminster. Perhaps he's been busy doing bus things or whatever. But you're right, he has to make a decision. He has to know where he stands. He has to understand our point of view. I wouldn't dream in a trillion years of going near the Labour Party again, ever, if he doesn't make that clear and he's the leader. Why would I? There's nothing in it for me. And people like me have had enough of this rubbish.
This now seems to be the question they fire at every single left-wing person before they've finished sitting down, and most of them actually just duck it and just pretend it's not there.
Who can define what a woman is, and whether those that have transformed to become their version of a woman are allowed in female-only spaces? And Andy Burnham seems has relit the fire.
Well, look, he's not the first Labour politician to have been embarrassed by this question. I think David Lammy said that he thought a woman or a man could grow a cervix. Keir Starmer famously couldn't answer the question about whether or not a woman could have a penis. But he was making these comments before the Supreme Court judgment, which made it very clear that in terms of the Equality Act, the definition of a woman is based on biology. So it'd be interesting to see if, like a lot of his colleagues, he backtracks from this position now that the prevailing cultural winds seem to have changed.
So it's difficult to work out, isn't it, whether or not Burnham is supportive of trans rights and LGBTQ plus rights. Back in 2019, he signed a letter with the other Labour mayors to make gender recognition easier. He built the first city region LGBT panel in the country. He pulled public money away from anyone selling conversion therapy. And at Manchester Pride, he said it flat out, "I support trans rights and I want that known." Well, anyway, after the Supreme Court redefined sex as biological, a lot of the front bench went quiet. He called the new guidance confusing and he went back to live and let live. And it has cost him. Duncan Bannatyne, remember him? Yeah. He's pulled his money and he's took it to Restore over precisely this. So the man now sold as the only one who can stop the right is also the senior figure still holding the line for trans people as that line empties out. Although he didn't speak too much about that on the campaign trail, not going to lie.
Everyone knows that politics isn't working. Everyone can feel that the country isn't where it should be. Tonight could, just could, be the turning point. From here on, I will give everything I have got to make it so, to ensure the name Makerfield is forever synonymous with bringing about the change this country needs. Bringing back something we've lost, hope, hope for the future.
It was a great speech for 3 o'clock in the morning, and I think he meant every word of it. But play it back and listen for the one word that is missing in all of that speech, and that word is Labour on the doorstep. He didn't run as a party, he ran as Andy. And when the result was read out, it landed as exactly that. This is Andy's result. This isn't Labour's result.
An extraordinary, seismic, titanic election result for Andy Burnham. He has not just won the by-election in Makerfield, he hasn't just squeaked it, he has absolutely stormed it with a majority of around 9,000, an absolute majority of over 50% of the vote in Makerfield. And it can undoubtedly only be described as a personal triumph and vindication. Keir Starmer did not want him to stand in this by-election. He only acquiesced because his authority was spent. But his premise, his idea, that is Andy Burnham, that only he could take on reform and win, at least in this constituency and this contest, has been completely vindicated. Don't listen to the spin over the next 24 hours. This was a prime reform target. It was in the top 20 of all target seats for the Reform Party. It needed only a modest swing. As with these figures, Reform and Rob Kenyon barely added to their total at the 2024 election.
Starmer didn't want him anywhere near this seat, and he gave way only because his own authority has run completely dry. And here is what the win really sets off. Not a celebration, it's more of a countdown. This seat makes Burnham an MP. Being an MP lets him stand for the leadership, and everyone knows what happens after that. So within hours of the declaration, the word went out from the top, hold the line, don't turn on each other, which tells you precisely how the result was read in Downing Street. So how did one man turn a reform clean sweep into a landslide in just 6 weeks?
This is the graph, this is the chart that shows just what a remarkable event it's been. What Andy Burnham managed to do, if you look at this, he got 54.8% of the vote. But look how small the Liberal Democrat and the Green vote is. This is sort of just over one percentage point. What does that tell us? That everybody on the left of politics united behind Andy Burnham. There's no splitting of the vote. Andy Burnham managed to really quite something quite remarkable in getting, as it were, the left of politics to all row in behind them. There was no splitting.
So there it is, you're seeing it, the maths on the right, reform and restore. They just couldn't share a room, could they? And this has proved that not everyone is on X. But Rupert Lowe's lot siphoned off just enough to cause reform a real problem, and long may that continue. On the left, the exact opposite happened. The kind of miracle scenario, really. Everybody fused behind Burnham, until the Greens and the Lib Dems barely had a single point. The Greens, to their credit, half got out the way on purpose, I think. The first candidate was gone in a day. That clearly wasn't on purpose. The grandees openly telling people to keep it down, because Burnham has apparently said behind the scenes that proportional representation, that looks interesting. The leadership are quietly pulling canvases to save themselves for the mayoralty. Which is why the word pact is suddenly everywhere, along with the promise that Burnham, as a reformer, brings in proportional representation, which mends the whole machine. But then today happened, didn't it? Ask yourself how a man stays really keen on changing these rules after he won 55%. We'll see what happens with that one. Now, the part nobody wants to say out loud on a night like this is, we have seen this film before. A likeable man of the left rides in, the room goes mad, hope walks back through the door, and then we find out what the hope is going to cost, and it's a lot of horse trading and it's incrementalism. Because Burnham didn't take Makerfield by being warmer than Farage. He took it by standing on a good deal of Farage's ground, rather disappointingly. In the week before the vote, he told BBC Radio Manchester he wants greater use of detention and faster removals for anyone with no valid claim. And his words, that he agrees with what Farage is saying. The country has to get back a sense of order. He's backed Labour's own asylum crackdown. The one his former deputy called un-British. So before we light the candles, the honest question for this audience, does a Burnham in number 10 make us safer, or does it only make the hostility slightly better spoken? There's two ways to read it. and I'm going to have to hold them both at once, because right now it looks like the only chance we've got. He is the most trusted, most likeable communicator the left, full stop, has. On that reading, he keeps the mob off the step, and behind that step, queer people still get a government that says out loud that it's behind them. Ish. It's the oldest trait there is, and it's the only one really we've ever been given as queer people. The left's great hope walks forward towards power and reaches for the migrant to put over to the side. And minorities, they're not one neat block. A settled gay man in the suburbs, as wise as I am, and a queer kid in an asylum centre are not getting the same deal out of this. One of them is a bit safer tomorrow. The other one has a bit more of a sense of who the order of things is coming for. And this is where it stops being about one northern seat. Across the water, Zohan Mamdani is now running New York, an insurgent who never filed the edges off. Free childcare, tax the rich, he didn't flinch on migrants to get there. Back here, Zach Polanski is dragging the Greens leftward and louder. He's been very quiet recently. Strange, doesn't it? I wonder why. Burnham is neither of them. He's not the online left kicking the door in. He's the system's own man, a cabinet minister from 20 years ago. He was Home Secretary under Tony Blair. He's been let back in the building. And here's the part that should travel. Everyone on every side told us this. That this kind of post-industrial Brexit vote in fed-up town was already gone to the hard right, and it was only a matter of time. And then they went to them and said, here's the hard right, and they said, no, it's the first red wall seat to look reform in the eye and turn it down. So the question they should be asking in New York, Berlin, Sydney, not just Wigan, all around the world, have the people of Makerfield just shown the rest of the Western world that the populist right is beatable, and it's beatable by someone who can talk to people like they're actually people? Or maybe the small print is the only way to beat the left is to start sounding just a bit like them. And that's the thought that I can't put down. If even the King of the North, the best hope we have, only wins by borrowing the other lot's lines, then what does the Labour Party stand for? What's the point in parties? Anyway, my guest today has written a whole book with an answer to that question, and the answer is absolutely nothing. He says that parties are not the cure for any of this. They are the disease. Metin Pekin is a businessman turned author, and his book is called Breaking Democracy's Change. His argument, put simply, is that it doesn't matter who wins because the parties hand you the same outcomes every time. Either way, they are the gatekeepers. They narrow the choice. They manufacture the division. They keep reformers and insurgents out. And yes, by his account, they are why the great left hope ends up talking like the right the moment he nears power, because that's what the party system makes him do. His fix is radical. Meton says that a no-party democracy is what we need. Power handed straight back to the people who live in the place. It's a gold award-winning book. It's a real provocation. I wanted to test it from where we sit as queer people, because people like us did not get our right by luck. Section 28, Equal Marriage, the Equality Act, Burnham's own LGBTQ plus panel, every inch of it came from organising inside parties and leaning on them until they actually moved. So I put the obvious challenge to him. Take the parties away. Does a minority end up with more protections or less? Is a no-party world our liberation, or is that really serious exposure to something terrifying? It's our conversation.
Queer politics.
When Farage says jump, Labour might say how high.
And it's not true. It's offering people false hope.
Sex.
Dating apps have become a breeding ground for the worst of human behaviours.
And culture.
What do you want, homie? We get together, we be simple. Simple. It's simple for me.
He will, like, go nosh himself off.
This is Outcast World.
If we take it a step back, at university, I studied political economy. So I've understood about politics, government, and so on and so forth. So I was able to digest some information differently, I suppose, to ordinary person on the street, if you like, with that help of that educated background. And what was striking is that we had a right-wing government under Bush in America, and we had a Labour government supposed to be left-wing government in UK, and yet they were joining forces to go to war under a false premise. There were no weapons of mass destructions. It was very abundantly clear that the dossier was sexed up, and whatever the terminology was used on the day. We know London streets were filled with up to a million people demonstrating, and similar sort of demonstrations happened across the globe. And yet the war had happened. So with that bit of a background and with what's happened, you sit back and say, well, do we really live in a democracy? Here, we're supposed to have a left-wing government that looks after the best interests of the people and what have you, because that's how we've seen it in the UK. Conservatives associated with the business, lower taxes, lower spending, Labour government more liberal, more public services and higher taxes maybe. That's how we perceive things. That's what the cues are about the politics. And when it comes to the key issues, likes of surveillance, likes of austerity, as we've seen in 2008 crash, banks were rescued and people were lectured about tightening their belts and being responsible. Likes of wars happens under both Labour and Conservative in Conservatives. And then I've kind of gave up and said, neither one of those parties is really serving the public. Just changing faces or parties don't necessarily change the outcomes. If you want outcomes to change, if you want different outcomes, you really do need to question the incentives. You really do need to question the systems.
When you say the incentives, kind of, what do you mean by that?
Well, the incentives, the best example that I can give you in business world, let's say, just so it's simple to understand. Let's say you employ a salesperson and you give them a basic salary. And that person will just do what's necessary, what he can get away with, basically the minimum possible, given we've got all this leisure activities around us. But if you change the incentive to say, okay, look, we're going to pay you this basic, and it's not the voter, and hence they can very comfortably ignore the will of the people. So people's will is being ignored, as we've seen in Iraq war and many, many instances across the spectrum. And our representatives, our MPs, are not working on behalf of the wider people, on behalf of the voters. They're working on behalf of the people who finance them.
And these people there is the oil, healthcare, gambling.
Well, absolutely correct, and including the special interest groups, military-industrial complex, you name it, fossil fuel companies. So all those people, big pharma, big finance. So these people, big tech, those people have so much more influence on the policies. And that is where the problem is. And I suppose my wake-up call, Iraq war was a turning point for me to go into my research, but my eureka moment came when I read the Federalist Papers, American Founding Fathers, 250 years ago, when they did their or designed their system, they were dead against political parties.
What was their reasoning for that?
The reason was that it will... Well, it's important to maybe just quote one or two of their points and then we'll go to the reasons. One of the founders had said... Madison, was it? Yeah, one of the fathers, anyhow, said... there's nothing I dread more than the Republic divided into two great parties, which they have now. One of them had said, if I was to go to heaven, if I was not to go to heaven, but with a party, I would not go there at all. I'd rather not go there at all. But given the circumstances, because they knew factions will capture the government, the factions, a group of people, will get together. and it becomes the majority rule over the minorities. And that was the problem that they foreseen. The world that they left behind in England and Europe and further afield, they've seen how party politics corrupted and how the elite had all the say in this. So they wanted to...
talking about the I'm going to bring it to stuff that's happened quite recently, the Peter Mandelsons, the Epstein class, that sort of people that can hijack through special interest, through dark money, through offshore sort of meets. It's them that you're suggesting that we sort of block out of our democracy through getting rid of parties. But then are the parties not the scaffolding for legislation and protections historically?
Good point. Yeah, good point. Now, look, I mean, historically, parties had fulfilled their job in a low information era. So when there was no television, no radio, no newspaper going back 250 years, parties are not part of democracy. They were not born out of a philosophical geniuses. They were a necessity in low information era to give people cues. Now, it's debatable how much cues they have provided, debatable how much scaffolding they provided for the minorities. Now, take...
Well, the Civil Rights Act, gay rights in the US and the UK, I don't see how they would have passed without the support of certain political structures.
Fair point, but these were not handed down on a plate, if we are honest with ourselves. When did the women's voting rights came in? How many years after the male suffrage? The female suffrage was somewhat nearly 3-4 centuries later. It was 1920s.
Yeah.
So it was 2010 when some of the rights were passed in the legislation. I mean, in 21st century, there is something to be embarrassed of. So democracy was not truly secular, free, democratic system under the party system. And I tell you for why it has not been. Now, we need to kind of establish, if we take parties out, what do we put in place of it and what is the structure? Now, all minority rights has to be taken care of by the constitution, by the law, and what have you. But, now that's an important question. And I do need to explain this structure that we propose putting in place instead of the parties before we can debate that question.
Yeah.
So the structure proposed in the book is this. We elect our 600 or so MPs without a party label. If you want to go to mechanics of that, we can do. But if you want to just for your viewers to follow the argument, let's just assume...
Sorry, can I go into the detail on the label? Because you need to know something about these candidates, don't you?
Absolutely correct. So let's deal with that. Then we'll progress in detail.
Yeah, yeah.
So I live in Doncaster, and we will have Labour, Greens, Reform, Conservative candidates for our MPs for our national general election. So instead of those labels, we will have Graham, suits and those
and
candidates.
Is that where we vote for them? Is that where we do that initial vote? Correct. Because parties can't do it. Right.
Correct. Absolutely. So those candidates now will have online. Their top 10 pledges. We will still vote as we do under the current system. We'll still go to the polling
pen
stations and we'll still vote. Absolutely correct. So the system
yeah.
does not change.
Okay.
All we see different is the when we turn up at the polling station, we are not voting Graham belonging to Green Party, Metin belonging to the or representing the Labour Party kind of a thing. We are voting for the individuals and their policies. So on the website and even on the ballot paper, we will see what they stand for, what their top pledges are.
What you just put them as like a couple of bullet points, wants to reduce workers' rights, wants to bring private healthcare into that kind of thing.
Up to, exactly that. And up to 10 points, their top 10 pledges. that's okay. digestible. That could be five, that could be six, that could be top 10. So we will know their position on immigration. We will know their position on LGBTQ position. We'll know their position on taxation, on whatever the top policies are. We will know where they stand on this, and they'll campaign on that. So
okay.
we will then vote for those individual representatives that are not enslaved to the party bosses.
Questions, if you're happy with
sure.
that.
Sure.
The US right now, the UK right now, that's where our listeners are. They are dismantling trans healthcare protections. They'll probably dismantle other healthcare things for the LGBTQ plus community, rolling back queer rights, rewriting DEI legislation. That is happening through a party system, but it is also being resisted in part through a party system. The Democrats, for example, the very broad church that they are, for all their failures, are the organised mechanism of that resistance. Under your model, where does that organised resistance live?
It's because the power is in the hands of the people, it will be much, much stronger. Much stronger, and for this following reason. So once we have these independent MPs, any group, any minority group, can decide who they want to represent them. And because the discussion is not whipped, or the voting is not whipped by the party bosses, there will be negotiations on behalf of any group, and we will find equal rights for everybody. And, you know, it's a shame that in this day and age, in what we call democracy, we are still having to debate these minority rights. We should, as a society, as a community, we should be ashamed of ourselves that we do not accept any group, any people, any expression. We should have that freedom.
Your book, you end it with Susan Sontag's observation, which I find so poignant. I always said, forgive the language, 20% of people are absolute bastards, but this is slightly different in how it lays it all out. The observation is 10% cruel, 10% merciful, 80% following whoever sets the tone. Right now, the cruel 10% seem to be setting that tone pretty loudly for the in the medium term. Let's say that. Where does your kind of optimism come from? Do you have any optimism around this? How do you think it's going to unravel?
Yes, I do. I really am optimistic, but it all depends how much effort we as individuals put in and how we do it, how much responsibility we take in. The problem is we've got our heads in the sand, and, you know, for various reasons, some through leisure, others through just trying to make ends meet, work, family, kids, absolutely busy and whatever it is. But regardless of what the circumstances are, we're not as bad as the war zone in Palestine, in Gaza. We still have our freedoms and we still can make a difference. So we need to unite, organize, and come to live in 21st century, defend our rights. Don't take it for granted, because gradually these will slip. And, you know, one time it was the Labour government that seemed more liberal and so on and so forth, and Greens were more, and what had happened? Change of leadership, the policy goes out of the window. Another group comes in that's against a smaller minority group. What happens? They get the priority, because they are not genuinely representing the minorities. They are basically aggregating the vote. And if they've got a bigger customer there, a bigger support there, they will gladly let go of the smaller. It's just economics. But true democracy, true representation at the constituency level, dispersing the power, is the biggest guarantee and the biggest power that every minority group will have, is my view.
Thank you so much for coming on. The book is Breaking Democracy's Chains, Met in Peking on No Party Democracy. A really fascinating chat. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Thanks, Graham.
Queer politics, sex, and culture. Outcast World.
Stay with me. This is incredibly simple. If you've ever used Grindr, Googled something rather personal, or posted anything political, your data is already being tracked and sold. Think about that. A VPN can make you a lot safer. NordVPN takes about 2 minutes to set up, one click to turn on, and it just runs in the background. There's no effort after that. It's consistently voted number one across a load of metrics for consumers. It's fast, it's secure, and there's no drop-offs. Outcast World listeners can get up to 75% off NordVPN right now, which brings it down to under £3 a month. Go to outcastworld.net, top of the page, tap the link, then you're done. Outcastworld.net for up to 75% off NordVPN.